Hello, listener. Welcome to the University of Maryland Extension presents the Garden Time Podcast, where we talk about getting down and dirty in your garden. We're your hosts. I'm Michaela.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Emily.
In this month's episode, we're chatting about all things fall.
So, I love spring and I love fall. Do you guys love fall as much as I do? Or am I the only one wearing scarves, boots, and drinking my pumpkin spice lattes?
Oh no, I'm as basic as they come. I love a fall. I love wearing boots. Mostly, I love the temperatures falling.
So do I.
Being from Wisconsin, I don't handle the heat in the summer very well. And now I'm starting to finally feel like I'm comfortable and the mosquitoes are dying and it makes me really happy. No. I can go back to hot drinks.
I'm from
again.
Maryland and I don't handle the temperature very well either.
The leaves are changing and it's pretty and the air gets crisp. And now I think fall is my favorite season too, Rachel. So you're definitely in like...
I love it. I love to wake up in the morning and go outside and smell somebody's wood stove burning. There's nothing better.
My favorite is being able to leave my windows open. Oh, yeah. Get that kind of like muggy, musty smell of summer out of my house.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a great time. And how do we know that it's fall, guys? What are some of the signs?
So for me, the first sign that it's fall is when you start to find chrysanthemums for sale at stores.
Absolutely. Yes.
Is that one of your favorite plants in the fall?
I really enjoy chrysanthemums. I think they're really pretty and they're really fun. I used to work at a public garden and we would in the fall have like a chrysanthemum show.
Oh, that's really cool.
And we had an amazing crew that would actually build like, the last year I was there, they built a zoo. So they built like a whole bunch of different animals and then they filled them with chrysanthemum plants. So they had like a giraffe and they had a polar bear and all this
stuff.
Oh,
that's really cool.
And I thought it was...
Like a chia pet? Like a chia pet of chrysanthemums?
Yeah. So I feel like they're really cool in that kind of way. They're also really easy to take care of. And as you guys know, I am not a plant person. We actually planted 2 chrysanthemums in front of our office building last year during the fall. And because of the pandemic, I wasn't able to like prune and rip them out this spring. And they're still there and they're getting ready to bloom. And I'm super excited.
Oh, yeah. We have some planted at our house. And every year, I usually trim them back about July, just so they don't get too leggy. And they're getting ready to bloom, too. I love having them by our farm.
So my favorite question is, where did these even come from? Because they're not native to Maryland. So how did chrysanthemums kind of get their beginnings?
So that's a great question. So you're right. Chrysanthemums, or mums for short, are not native to North America. They're actually native to East Asia and Northern Europe. We can actually date them back to 6th century in China, which is when they were first cultivated from kind of a wild variety. There's over 100 different cultivars of chrysanthemums and 13 different designated classes. The nice thing about chrysanthemums is they're a fairly hardy perennial plant that easily adds a pop of color to the fall landscape. You can find them in a wide variety of colors from white to yellow to oranges and reds and even purplish pinks now.
So you can find one to match any color scheme that you have going on in your garden.
And I actually think they're really cool because even when they're not in bloom, they have that nice deep green color to them that also kind of can help off-put some of the other different shades of green that potentially could be in your garden because they're not normally an over shiny leaf. They're kind of more of a, I don't want to say dull or flat, but they have a texture, but it's definitely not like shiny. Yeah.
Agreed. So the way that chrysanthemum flowers are arranged is very similar to a lot of our asters and daisy flowers because they all belong to the family Asteraceae. Chrysanthemum flowers are very unique that they have a multitude of petals, but each individual petal is actually a small floret. And there are 2 different types of florets. They're ray and disc florets. So the ray florets are what we traditionally see as the petals, while the disc florets create the center buttons. So while you would think of that as the center of a normal flower, those are actually just tiny, tiny florets. And when they're all clustered together, they give us what we know and love as a mum bloom.
Awesome. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because I think what I always loved about chrysanthemums was how they had so many more petals and they were so, like, packed full.
So the best time to plant chrysanthemums is in the spring to give them the most time for establishment. Although some fall mums can survive winter if planted early in the fall, the odds are much better in the spring. When you are visiting garden centers in the spring, you want to look for small plants. And you want to make sure that they're fall hardy as well. Our zone is 5 through 9. And then some varieties, such as the mammoth daisy, are hardy down to zone 3. They love to be planted in full sun, and they like to have well-drained soil.
You want to make sure that when you are planting mums out in your landscape, whether you're doing it in early fall or waiting until spring, that you take size into consideration. Full-grown mum plants can be up to 3 feet high and 3 feet wide. So you want to make sure that you're not putting your mum plants too close together, because this will lead to potential disease issues as well as competition amongst the root systems. On the label for your mum plant, there should be information about spacing and the variety's needs as well. The nice thing about chrysanthemums in general is that they are fairly low maintenance. And one of the great things is that you don't have to actively prune them. What you can do, however, is pinch them back, and this will cause them to branch out and become fuller and have more blooms every single year. So when your plant reaches about 6 inches tall in the spring, you just want to pinch off the top inch of every single shoot, and then you'll repeat this every 2 to 3 weeks during the summer, and then by end of summer, you should have a fairly full plant that should be ready to have lots of blooms. You want to go ahead and deadhead any of the spent blooms throughout the fall. This will continue to cause the plant to make blooms.
Quick question. Do you guys have any good advice for how to keep chrysanthemums from falling out in the middle? Do you know what I mean? Like, they kind of like droop, or they create that big hole. Any good advice for keeping them kind of lush and full?
I cut mine back like mid-June to early July with some loppers. And that helps them from getting so leggy. Because if you have that hardy variety, they're going to get leggy in the summer. Well,
I think that's what we were talking about with the whole, like, pinching them back. So you're not cutting, like, the idea is to cut them back and then keep cutting them back repeatedly. And they'll grow, but then it's contained.
Yeah, I just do one big chunk of a lopper to them, and they're fine.
Or maybe you can, like, tie around the outside and try and pull them back up or something.
Well, you could always put a peony cage around them as well.
Oh, that's a good idea.
To try to keep them contained. After peony season is over, just take that off and put it over top your mums so that they'll grow right through it.
I knew you guys would have good advice.
Yeah.
Because that's one of my drawbacks to not liking mums very much is that they always seem to kind of like drop out in the middle.
Yeah, they do.
Kind of sad and saggy.
Yeah. So what do I need to do to take care of these things in the winter, Emily?
So some great tips that you can do in order to help any of these fall chrysanthemums that you've decided to plant make it through the winter is to add a thick layer of mulch. And normally we talk about just mulching in kind of thin layers, just enough to kind of cover the soil. But in this case, when preparing for winter, you do want to make it a little bit thicker. So somewhere between about 3 to 4 inches. And what this really does is help to maintain an even soil temperature throughout the winter. And this is a good tip even for other plants besides chrysanthemums. So if you have any other plants that you kind of got in the ground a little bit late in this fall season and you're worried about their ability to overwinter, adding mulch will really help with their root system.
Can you also use leaves as that kind of mulch?
So you can use things like leaves or straw or something like that. You just want to make sure that it's a thick enough layer, because ideally you don't want that soil underneath them to freeze. don't want it getting down into the 20s because that's what's going to actually kill and or damage their root system.
So you want to think of it almost like a big, thick comforter over top of them or like a down jacket. You're giving them a nice little insulator for the winter to help protect those roots, right?
Yeah, more like a pair of insulated pants, though, because the whole top part is still exposed. Please don't go out there and throw actual blankets over your plants. That will
exactly,
not
Exactly, exactly. No, we're not saying that.
Pumpkin time!
Rachel, do you have some really cool pumpkin trivia up your sleeve today?
I sure do. How did you know?
I just know. I know these things. Hit me with some pumpkin trivia, Rachel.
All right. Did you know that 80% of the pumpkin supply in the United States is available in October?
No. I mean, it makes sense, though.
When else would it be available?
Exactly.
September, July? November, I guess? Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, considering how most pumpkins are, what, 90 to 120 day germination?
Yeah. I was just going to ask
bring out the science
that.
Facts.
It takes a while for those pumpkins to get to size.
Yep.
Yes, it does. So, do you know how long pumpkins have been grown in North America?
Oh.
Would you think the Native Americans grow them?
Yeah, squashes are a New World vegetable, I recall. Because the Native Americans used to do the three sister with the squash, the corn, and
sure.
the pea.
Yep.
The bean, yeah.
The bean, sorry, the bean. The bean, mm-hmm. the corn, and the squash. And yeah. I mean, pumpkins are a cucurbit, but I assumed that they were.
Yeah, 5,000 years. Well. They've been in North
really?
America for 5,000 years.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Wow.
How about the largest pumpkin or the heaviest pumpkin ever grown was 2,624 pounds grown in Belgium in 2016.
Whew. That's a big pumpkin.
That is a
That's
big
a lot of
pumpkin.
Pie.
Well, I don't think it was a pie pumpkin.
No? Okay.
Okay, so the largest pumpkin pie ever baked was 2,020 pounds, and it measured more than 12 feet and took 5 hours to bake and produced 3,000 slices of pie.
Nice. Did either one of you guys happen to get a slice of that? Because I definitely didn't get my slice, and I feel very cheated.
I didn't either. I feel cheated.
Although, I'll be honest with you guys, I don't particularly like pumpkin pie.
What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you?
I'm sorry, Emily. You're kicked out of the group.
Yeah.
You're kicked out of the band.
I know that she doesn't like pumpkin pie. She doesn't like cilantro. The next thing is she's going to say that she doesn't like cats.
I have cats. It's obvious I like cats.
She's like, no. False.
I like the flavoring of pumpkin pie. There's something about the texture that I just don't particularly
yeah,
like.
Yeah, that's how I feel about tomatoes.
I've had like pumpkin pie cookies where it's like pumpkin and like oatmeal and stuff like that. So I think it's just that whole like, it's a whole pie that all just has the same texture in it.
Yeah.
Do you like squash soup, like the pureed squash soups?
So I didn't when I was younger. I've started to get more into them as I've gotten older. So
just curious.
I may start, like, I'm not going to say, like, no, I'm not going to eat this piece of pumpkin pie. But if there's, like, cherry or apple pie and pumpkin pie, I'm going to pick, like, an actual, like, sweet fruit pie over a pumpkin pie.
See, I could eat a whole pumpkin pie by myself.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. My husband doesn't like pumpkin pie either. He likes the cherry or the apple, and I could, like, down a whole pumpkin pie.
See, I can easily pass on fruit pies, but a pumpkin pie, no way.
Yeah, same here. Like, I could eat pumpkin pie for breakfast. Because, well, I think pie is a breakfast food anyway, but...
Dude, I think it's healthy because pumpkin is really good for you.
It is.
Pumpkin has a lot of nutritional benefits.
Great. When we get off here, I'm going to be making myself a pumpkin pie, by the way.
I know. I'm already thinking about it. I'm like, do I have the supplies at home?
I do. I have all the supplies. Now I'm going to be making one.
I guess the question is how much sugar has to go into a pumpkin pie? And does that nutrify all the amazing nutrition that comes from pumpkin?
Shh. Shut your mouth.
You could probably control some of that sugar if you're baking it yourself, which is the nice part, right?
Yes. Oh, man. So good. So did you know that pumpkins were once recommended for removing freckles and curing snake bites?
Huh.
Huh. I wonder how many snake bites it actually cured. People, please don't do this.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's the idea of, like the wetness, like, drawing the venom out. Like, freckles is obviously not true.
Exactly.
But, like, with the snake bite, if you could somehow, like, I'm wondering if they're using, like, the pulp and stuff inside, or if they're using more of the fleshy rind.
Yeah, tying it on your leg, like a steak.
Maybe.
No, that's...
Or if it's just a matter of, like, if it's something cold, so it's like a cold compress before we have available ice, maybe.
Maybe.
Who knows? That's really neat.
It is.
I find that interesting.
All right, so the history of pumpkins. Archaeological evidence suggests that pumpkins and winter squash are native to the Americas from the southwestern part of what is now the United States through Mexico and Central America and into Peru, Ecuador, and Colombia. Pumpkins have been cultivated since about 3000 BC, rivaling that of corn as one of the oldest known crops in the Western Hemisphere. Native Americans are said to have roasted long strips of pumpkin as a food source. They also dried pumpkin strips and wove them into mats. Presumably, American colonists relied heavily on pumpkin as a food source as well.
Well, and that kind of makes sense because they're pretty easy to grow, they have lots of nutrition, and they're fairly hardy with regard to storage, if I recall.
Yes, they are. They're very, very easy to store.
So those novelty, whimsical kind of pumpkins are all the craze for fall decorating. And now there's lots of varieties. So there's a lot of different cultivars available. There's pumpkin batwing mix. And this is a unique ornamental that produces about half to a pound size fruit. Many of them look like they have this novel dipped in dark green paint kind of look. The batwing will produce a variation of fruit colors, with some being completely orange, some are part green or dark green. And a good quantity of them being half orange, half green. And these are great to set out in the centerpiece of your dinner table or to put them in a cornucopia, so to speak. Color will be expressed best when planted later and then harvested earlier than some of the other varieties.
So one of my favorite pumpkins that we always grow at the research farms are the warty goblin pumpkins. And these are the ones that are heavily warted, which I think looks really cool. And so normally these guys are orange with green warts on them.
I love those too. They're one of my favorites.
I feel like they would make a very good witch decorated face kind of pumpkin because of all the funky little warts.
Oh yeah.
Yes, they would. So my favorite, and is probably as basic as they come, is the Cinderella pumpkin. Known for their flattened appearance, largely used as ornamental pumpkins, they were popular in France in the 1880s. They can be used by home gardeners and chefs for soups and pies.
This is also one of my favorites, Rachel.
Really? And I love them.
Yeah. And they come in really cool colors, too. So they'll come in like a dark reddish-orange color, yeah. But they also have kind of like almost a minty green kind of color.
Yes, I love that one, too.
Dark green. Yeah, so the really gorgeous colors on these. And they're pretty large. Another one I'm really excited to try growing next year, and this is not necessarily a pumpkin, but it is a gourd. It's the birdhouse gourd.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those are beautiful.
Yeah, they're super easy. They're beautiful, and they're really fun if you have kids, too, because then you can kind of do the birdhouse with the gourd once it's dried out at the end of the season. So it's kind of multifaceted.
I would say that if you are going to grow these for birdhouses, make sure that you wear a mask when you're cleaning them out, because that dust is very fine. It was very irritating to me when I did it.
So another fun thing you can do if you have the space is attempt to grow some giant pumpkins. So these would be those large pumpkins that are 100+ pounds that either people put out for decoration out in the front yard, or these are the ones that people will oftentimes do the chucking with. You do want to make sure that you plant these in a full sunny area and well-drained soil. And that's for any of these pumpkin varieties that we've talked about. These ones in particular, because of how large you're trying to get them, are going to need a lot of water, but they don't want to sit in wet soil. So that's why that well-drained soil is ideal. to get them to this size, you are going to need to get them in a little bit in the earlier side, because they are going to take anywhere from about 100 to 120 days in order to get to that 100 plus range. Once they do start vining and they get to be about softball size, you're going to want to go through and prune out all of, except for 1 to 3 of the fruit, because ideally you want the plant to really focus on those fruits. As well as once they get to that size, you are going to want to go through and start trimming back your vines to about 20 feet, as well as pinch off any and all fruit or additional flowers that the plant starts to put on. Because again, you want the plant to put all of its energy into the fruit. Some great varieties that we recommend and have been grown out on our research farm is Dill's Atlantic Giant and Big Max. So the Atlantic Giant one is going to get you into the 400-500 pound one, versus Big Max is going to get you closer to just about the 100-pound one. And I actually think Big Max is a really pretty one. And the nice thing about Big Max is, on top of its nice size, is it actually has a really good pulp to it that can be used for things like pies and bread. Versus Dill's Atlantic Giant is kind of just there for the massive amount of size. And if you want more tips about doing big pumpkins, I would recommend checking out the Home and Garden Information Center. We have a whole page about how to kind of grow all these big pumpkins.
That's really good advice, Emily.
That is really good advice.
And not everybody knows that you can't just put a seed for a pumpkin in the ground. They're really heavy feeders, so they need a lot of fertilizer. And they also have a high water requirement, so you have to water them a lot in order to get to these kind of larger sizes.
So along with pumpkins and gourds, one other thing that a lot of people like to decorate in the fall with is Indian corn. So Rachel, can you tell us a little bit about Indian corn?
So Indian corn is a really easy thing to grow in your garden as well, or to purchase. I really want to grow glass gem corn next year.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a gorgeous, translucent, jewel-colored corn. And each kernel is unique. It has a stunning variety selected over the years by Carl Barnes. He's a Cherokee farmer and breeder from Oklahoma. He selected this variety from crossing several different varieties of corn and saving the seeds from the most vivid and translucent kernels. If you'd like to know a little bit more about glass gem corn, you can go to the nativeseeds.org and type in glass gem. And they have a whole history of how he found this corn and how he's been working with it over the years. It's an absolutely beautiful batch of Indian corn. And it comes in like deep purples and has some pinks. It's amazingly beautiful.
I had a friend who grew it this year in her garden with her little boy. And it is really pretty because you've got like some kernels will be pink, and the one next to it will be yellow, and then there'll be a blue one, and then there's a green one, and there's like it's literally like a rainbow ear of corn. It's worth noting that this is not like an edible, so this isn't like sweet corn or popcorn, so you wouldn't eat this though.
No, and a lot of the different seed companies will limit you on the amount of packets that you can buy because this is an heirloom variety. So it's not as widely available as your traditional Indian corn. One of my favorite winter squash to grow in the garden is PA Dutch crookneck squash. It's gorgeous and enormous. Each fruit weighs about 10 to 20 pounds, and it has this beautiful crook neck. So at the bottom of the crook, it has all of the seeds, and you just peel it and slice it off and then discard the chunk with the seeds in it. It's great for roasting or making pies. It stores very well, and it's about 100 to 110 day variety. It produces so much. I put in like 3 plants a year, and I probably get a full bushel basket full of winter squash, and I love it.
I just Googled an image of it. They are way cool looking.
They're amazing. And you can get one packet of seeds and share it with all your friends. Because
is it related to butternut squash? Because it looks almost exactly like it, except the bendy neck.
Yes, it is almost the same as butternut, as you would in the texture and the taste. But it's a lot easier to prepare. Because, you know, butternut is so big and you have to chop it in half and then you have to peel it. This is a lot easier to peel and slice.
Okay. I see what you mean from the pictures about, like, all the seeds are just in a little, like, end butt of it, too.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like, think about a crookneck acorn squash, kind of. That's what it kind of reminds me of.
Acorn squash. Yum.
Yeah. It's very good. And it's hard to find this variety, so...
It's the native plant of the month with Michaela.
It's native plant of the month with Michaela. So it's actually my native tree of the month, and it's white oak, which is also known as Quercus alba. And oaks belong to the beech family, and they're a very common deciduous native tree that can reach really great heights of 80 to 100 feet tall. And although they're very slow growing, oaks are very long-lived and look really stately in the landscape. There are many oak species that are native to Maryland, but the white oak is actually also our state tree. More specifically, it's the Y oak, spelled W-Y-E, which is a specimen that was growing in Y Mills on the eastern shore of Maryland. And although it has since fallen, the Y oak stood over 90 feet tall and had a circumference of 31 feet. It was a national champion for the species, and it was estimated to be around 450 years old.
Whew, that's an old tree.
Yep.
That's amazing.
It was the second national champion ever declared in the United States, which is pretty incredible, but it was the national champion for the species. So the reason I've chosen this native for October is, well, first it has really nice fall color. Oaks are really classic in the fall because they have great amounts of acorns. And those acorns are super beneficial. They have very high wildlife value, not just for mammals, but for birds and insects. And it's some of the most attractive bark that I've seen on a mature tree. It's a very light gray. It almost looks white, which might be why it has the name it has. But it gets really flaky with age. And so it's got really great texture, really great color. I can actually pick out a white oak tree in the winter because the bark is just so distinctive to me.
Well, that's because you're amazing too.
Yeah.
I love white oaks. I will mention that there are several pest and disease issues, but most of them aren't fatal. It would take several years or, a detrimental environmental kind of influence for these trees to come down or to die. So the benefits far outweigh those negatives. Don't let that hold you back from planting oaks because they just are one of those landmark trees that provide so much for our wildlife. And they're great at providing shade. They're long-lived and most of them are very, very strong. So if you plant anything this fall, try to make it an oak tree.
What's buzzing? It's the bug of the month with Emily. So this month's bug of the month is not actually a bug, or it's not an insect, I should say. So for this month's bug of the month, I've chosen to do orb weaver spiders. This is the family Araneidae, and again, this is a spider, so it's not an insect. These are arachnids. But these are kind of your larger garden spiders fall within this family, as well as your kind of smaller orb weaver spiders, because obviously it's the orb weaver family. A lot of your fall web building spiders fall into this category. They get their name of orb weaver spiders because these guys make that kind of classic spiral wheel-shaped webs that tend to be vertical, and you tend to find them in your gardens as well as in fields and forests. So this is that very typical web that's circles inside of circles inside of circles with spokes coming out. And then your larger species within this family, so things like the yellow or golden garden spider or the bandit garden spider, will have that big zigzag going down the front of the web as well. So you'll oftentimes find orb weaver spiders' webs next to or on buildings next to lights during the evening time. And they do this because ideally you have a lot of like moths and other flying insects that are attracted to that light at nighttime. So by putting their web there, they're basically getting a lot of food because she's basically getting ready to lay her eggs and build her egg sac. So she needs all that extra protein and food right now. So she will lay her egg sac sometime in during the fall months. And then she will die with the first frost, and her babies will overwinter in that egg sac, and they will hatch out in the spring. So those larger garden spiders can get up to about 28 millimeters in length, but a lot of our orb weavers that you'll find next to lights are smaller. So things like the spotted orb weaver or the cross orb weaver or the spiny orb weaver are all going to be closer to about 20 millimeters in size. But again, they're still going to have those token kind of ring inside a ring inside of ring webs. I actually think the cross orb weaver is a really pretty one. It's got sort of a pale yellow-brown abdomen to it, but it's going to have white and yellow spots on the top that will come in like a cross-like pattern. So it's kind of like a slash and then a dot and then a slash and then two slashes off to the side. So it is kind of a really neat-looking spider as well. And then your spotted one is going to be a mixture of kind of a dull brown on the top and hairy, but if you were to look on the underside of that abdomen, it's going to be very black and have two very bold white spots.
We have a spiny orb weaver that built a web outside our front door, and I love watching her.
Yeah.
They're so cool looking.
That one's what, the cream and black with the red spikes?
Yes.
Oh, those guys are so cool.
I know, they're really cute and squat.
I really like the pumpkin orb weaver, like the bright orange one. Yeah. That's one of my favorites.
That one is a really pretty one. You have an orange variety that's like a bright orange, or you also have like a cream variety, but the legs on it, as well as the cephalothorax, are going to be a very nice orangey hue. That's also one of the ones that doesn't actively sit on its web. It tends to have a little pocket that it hides out in.
Yeah, this one hides behind the light that we have. So there's like a little like half inch gap between the light and the siding. So she just hangs out back there. And then when a moth flies in, she's like, gotcha.
Nice. Really neat diversity in this group. They're really cool spiders. Again, they're super beneficial. So if you do find them and you're not too keen on having them, you can easily just gently take like a stick or something and you can knock down their web and they will go build a web someplace else. You don't need to go smushing them or killing them or anything like that. So that is my spider of the month.
Get your tip of the month here with Rachel.
So autumn is the perfect time to walk around your garden and to take inventory of what worked, what didn't, and what you think you'd like to change for the next growing season. I know for me, top priority in my garden is to plant more flowering bulbs like daffodils, crocus, tulips, and alums. Each year, I add a little bit more. You can theme part of your garden beds with different colors. It's a must for my garden. You want to make sure that you get these in before our first hard frost. It's also the ideal time to divide perennials that have died back. I prefer to do this in the fall rather than in the spring because it allows new plants to set good, healthy roots before the heat of the summer. And you'll need to do this 4 to 6 weeks before our first frost. So our first frost is usually close to Thanksgiving. If you did any ground layering of hydrangeas in June and July, now would be the time to check those plants, and if they're well established, you can go ahead and separate them and move them and get those planted. It's also seed collection time. I have one big raised bed full of annuals. So I have zinnias, cosmos, marigolds. And now is the time when I cut the seed heads off when the plants are dry and I put them in a labeled container and put them in the crisper of my refrigerator for next year. I've been doing this for about 10 years. The key is to make sure the plants have dried all the way down, because if you don't, you'll be growing mold. It's also a great time to collect perennial seeds. Leave some for the wildlife. Many of our perennial plants need cold stratification. In nature, certain conditions are needed for seeds to germinate. Some require warm and moist treatment, while others require cold, wet treatment. Therefore, knowing what seeds require to break their dormancy is critical before beginning any seed stratification project. Michaela, what seeds would you suggest for fall collection?
Oh, man. What a good question. So I would say just in general, a lot of the perennial natives will need some kind of stratification. So it'll need a simulation of winter, or even better, if you sow them in pots in like November and December, just let nature do its thing. And then you'll start to have some seedlings sprout up in the summer, or I'm sorry, in the next spring or summer. In general, a lot of the native grasses do not require that dormancy, but sometimes I give them that cold period anyways, because that's what nature does, and it hasn't hurt germination rates for most grasses. So when in doubt, just go ahead and give them a stratification period. Some really good fall collection seeds, especially this time of year, late in the season, are asters. They have pretty good success rates as far as seeding. I know a lot of the spring ones too. Irises are already kind of spent. Oh, a lot of the seashore mallows, both the hibiscus and the coatsteletskia, those are really great native plants to collect. Those are kind of like big seed pods that stand upright. So they tend to hold on to a few more seeds, even when they kind of crack open. A lot of the milkweed pods are probably come and gone at this point. But if you can scrounge out some pods that haven't split yet, you want to tie like a rubber band or something around them so they, when they do split, they don't lose all their seeds right away and you can come and collect them. And of course, it's a really great time for collecting the native grasses. If you have any other questions as far as that's concerned, or you have any other questions for us on the podcast, you can reach us by emailing umegardenpodcast@gmail.com.
Great. Thank you. I also think it's a great time to clean up your vegetable garden. So you want to rip out any diseased plants that you have laying around. Please don't compost them. Put them in a black trash bag. Get rid of them off your property. Disinfect your tomato cages. We have bacterial issues in the Northeast that really can wreak havoc on your tomatoes. And those issues can be exacerbated by diseased tomato cages or diseased tomato stakes. So you want to make sure you remove all the dirt and debris from your stakes or your cages. Just spray them down with a hose because the dirt and debris can be deactivated by your cleaning solution. Mix up a 10-to-1 bleach solution, 9 parts water, 1 part bleach. Spray down your cages and wipe them off. If you're using wooden stakes, you'll need to soak those for 30 minutes and then let them dry in the sun. Make sure your garden soil has been covered with either a cover crop or you can do some lasagna gardening.
I like that term, Rachel.
So you just want to layer straw and then newspaper and then leaves, cardboard, and just keep doing it over and over and over to cover that garden up.
So when you do that lasagna gardening, about how long does it take before you can kind of plant in that garden? Should you wait until spring?
Yeah, I would wait until spring.
Okay. Yeah, so don't plant in it now.
No, don't plant in it now. It's just used to cover up your ground. And then if you could actually do this in an area that you want to create, a new perennial bed or anything like that, where you could just layer it down, kill off the grass, and then plant right through it in the spring.
Very cool.
It's also a really good time to organize your garden tools, make sure that they're clean and sharpened. Drain your hoses and your irrigation lines. Put everything up and away so it's ready for you to use in the spring. Put your containers and your pots in an area that isn't subject to the freeze-thaw cycles. So that would be in a shed or a garage, because those ceramic pots can crack with our freezing temperatures in the winter. I also like to dig up my tender bulbs right now. So that's anything with a bulb corum rhizome tuber, and they won't survive our cold winters. So that's calla lilies, canna, dahlia, elephant ear, gladiolas, and then tuberous begonias. The University of Wisconsin in Madison has a great website for storing tender bulbs in the winter, and we'll put that up on our Facebook page for everybody to see. And that's all I have for my tips of the month.
Rachel, those are such good tips. I was like taking notes as we were going, because these are all things I need to do before the fall gets away from me. There's always so much to do, but they were really good tips.
It is, and I feel like every year I need something else to do. Well, that's all we have for this episode, listener. We hope that you enjoyed it and will tune in next month for more gardening tips. If you have any garden-related questions, please email us at umegardenpodcast@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook at Garden Time Podcast. That's Garden THYME.
For more information about the University of Maryland Extension and these topics, please check out the University of Maryland Extension Home and Garden Information Center website at extension.umd.edu/HGIC. Thanks for listening and have fun getting down and dirty in your garden.
Goodbye!
The Garden Time Podcast is brought to you by the University of Maryland Extension. Michaela Boley, Senior Agent for Horticulture in Talbot County, Rachel Rhodes, Agent Associate for Horticulture in Queen Anne's County, and Emily Zobel, Senior Agent Associate for Agriculture in Dorchester County.
University programs, activities, and facilities are available to all without regard to race, color, sex, gender identity or expression, sexual orientation, marital status, age, national origin, political affiliation, physical or mental disability, religion, protected veteran status, genetic information, personal appearance, or any other legally protected class. And I know Rachel recently found one of those large garden spiders.
Can I tell you about this story? Because holy moly. So I recently found a garden spider at the back of our garage, and I saw it and I pointed it out to the boys and I was like, don't touch this spider because she eats other bugs. She's a good spider to have around, but she's kind of big and we don't want to mess with her. So that same evening, my son woke up at 11:30 at night, scared that a spider was in his room and it was biting him, and it took me until 1 a.m. to get him back to sleep. So the next day, I went out to check on the spider, and she was gone. So I was like, all right, spider moved on. Then the following day after that, I get up super early because my kids never sleep, and I'm opening up our door to our side door to go outside, and guess where spider decided to put her web? Right there in the middle of our door frame. And I was like, girl, you're gonna have to move. We're gonna have to move you away because I told Oliver that spider was gone and now spider's back and I like to sleep. So I just took a broom and I didn't hurt her. I just took the broom, put her on the broom and moved her to the back of the house so that she's on our back door now, where she can be as happy as she wants by the back door light, not by our side door.